When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome back to the Dirst Show. Before we get to the issue of the Middle East and Israel and a possible ceasefire, and I'm going to give you some surprising news about that, let's go to the Trump court. So now we have really macho, mano-a-mano confrontation. The judge says, hey, one more contempt out of you, you're off to Rikers. And Trump says, yeah, going to jail is no big deal. The Constitution is more important. We'll see. Let's see if the judge tries to impose in prison. If he does, he will be reversed. If not, by the appellate court and the Court of Appeals, by the Supreme Court. The gag order is plainly unconstitutional. And what he imposed the contempt for was clearly unconstitutional. The purpose of a gag order is to protect the defendant. The Supreme Court has never upheld a gag order, which is designed to protect the prosecution. There's no conflicting rights there. If you have a defendant's Sixth Amendment right pitted against the First Amendment right of the newspapers, okay, there's a conflict, and the courts have resolved that conflict, mostly, by the way, in favor of the First Amendment. But there's no conflict in this case. Prosecution doesn't have a right. They have an interest, but they have no right. So there's no conflict. And the idea of telling a defendant that he can't respond to allegations made by another witness, or he can't complain about the jury pool. Today I was watching, I hate to admit it, but I was watching CNN for a minute. And the legal commentator said, oh, it's a fair jury. It's representative of New York. Duh. That's exactly why it's not a fair jury, because it's exactly representative of New York. 85% of whom hate Donald Trump and will do anything in their power to prevent him from running successfully for president. Oh, but they all said, yeah, we're prejudiced against Trump, but don't worry, we can be fair. Oh, has anybody ever said they can't be fair? Yeah, if you want to get off a jury, you say you can't be fair. But the idea that somebody who wants to be on a jury would admit, I can't be fair. I can't be fair. No. So this is an extraordinarily unfair jury, an extraordinarily unfair judge, an extraordinarily unfair prosecutor. And we'll see what the jury ends up doing. All you need is two or three jurors, not one. One generally will be persuaded to go with the majority. It's happened before, 12 Angry Men, we all know that. And in the O.J. Simpson case, a woman named Denise Ashenbeck, who was a previous jury that had been 11-1 for an acquittal, she turned them around and made them go for conviction. We were worried about her, but she voted for acquittal in the O.J. Simpson case. And then a few weeks later said, oh, she regretted her vote. But we'll see what a jury can do. You need usually three, a core of people to hold out if you're going to get a hung jury, because the judges do everything in their power to prevent a hung jury. They use what they call the dynamite instruction. Oh, you should listen to your jurors, but don't stick to your opinions if they're, you know, terrible instruction. I call it the ex-lax instruction because it's designed to loosen you up. But the end result is what the end result of ex-lax often is. So I don't like the ex-lax instruction or the dynamite instruction or this trial. And we'll see what happens. It's, you know, it's not the end of the road, although obviously the goal is to get a conviction without regard to whether it will be reversed on appeal. And it probably would be reversed on appeal. All right. Speaking of phony issues, let's turn to the Middle East. Now, Hamas, very cleverly, but in a totally phony way, has come up with a counter proposal. But of course, CNN thinks it's the most wonderful thing in the world. And I'm sure the New York Times will think it's the most wonderful thing in the world, and Israel is at fault. Here's what happened, just so you know. They're the facts. The United States, Egypt, Qatar, and Israel came up with a proposal very one-sidedly against Israel, but Israel agreed to it. They would get 33 hostages back, just 33 hostages. They'd have to give up hundreds and hundreds of murderers in exchange. And also they'd have to give Hamas a six-week ceasefire, which would allow them to regroup and allow them to, you know. Israel was very reluctant, but they accepted it. Okay. No headlines. No headlines. You don't get any newspapers. No student demonstrations saying, wow, well, let's stop the demonstrations. Israel just accepted a ceasefire. We were calling for a ceasefire. Now Israel has said, yes, maybe we should stop calling for death to Israel and death to America. Israel knows how to take yes for an answer. And it said, yes, we'll accept the ceasefire proposed by Egypt, Qatar, the United States, and Israel. Okay. That should have been the story. That was not the story. Almost no newspaper ran a story saying Israel accepts ceasefire. But tomorrow's headlines are going to be Israel rejects ceasefire. Why? Because Hamas knows how to play the media very well. It knows how to play the CNN game. It knows CNN's on its side. It knows the New York Times is on its side. It knows that Amanpour and Zakaria are on its side. So it came up with a totally phony counterproposal. Basically, it said to his experts, give us a proposal that we know Israel can't accept. It's the opposite of the Godfather. I'll make you an offer you can't refuse. In this case, Hamas decided it's going to make Israel an offer it can't accept. And so it made an offer. It said, basically, we'll send a few hostages back, but you have to end the war for good and allow Hamas to remain in power and allow us to keep our promise that we will do October 7th again and again and again and again and again. How could Israel possibly accept that? Now, the families of hostages are telling Israel, accept it, but Israel shouldn't listen to them. Sorry. It's a tragedy that your family are hostages, but you can't give up the safety and security of 8 million people in exchange for some hostages. It's a tragic reality, but Israel has to stand tough. Now, Israel has said it's going to go back to the negotiating table. And it will. And it may make yet another counteroffer so it can be on the side of, well, Israel makes a counteroffer. CNN won't run that. Don't worry. And the Times won't run that. Maybe the Wall Street Journal will, and maybe Fox will, and maybe Newsmax will. But, you know, this is such biased reporting by CNN and the Times and MSNBC. And so we're going to see what happens. But there is no offer on the table now that Israel can accept. The real question is Israel going to go into Rafah? I suspect the Hamas offer, which is a fake offer, was designed to put pressure on Israel not to go into Rafah. Already, the Biden administration has said, no, don't go into Rafah under any circumstances. The spokesperson for the National Security Council wouldn't even answer the question, well, what if it was a limited incursion? I'm not going to get into that. So the goal is to prevent Israel from going into Rafah, which it should do. And yes, there will be some civilians who die, but Israel can do a great deal, as it's already been doing a great deal, to prevent civilian deaths. First, it's opening up a corridor and urging civilians. Already today, it dropped leaflets, made phone calls, had loudspeakers in Arabic, telling them where to go and that they won't be subject to Israeli attacks. But that's not good enough for the United States. So what happened over this weekend? Israel accepted the offer. There's an offer on the table. Israel accepted it. How did Hamas respond? It killed four Israeli soldiers at the Rafah crossing, where all the food comes in. As a result, they had to close the crossing. And as a result, Hamas people were down to a meal and a half a day rather than two meals a day, some of them. If you see pictures of what's going on in many parts of Gaza, there's an overabundance of food. There's plenty of food. There are markets and stalls with fresh fruit and fresh vegetables and lots of grain, lots and lots of food. But there are some parts where they're not. Recently, the United States reported that Hamas stole medicine that was sent through a checkpoint for sick Gazan civilians. But Hamas stole the medicine and took it away from the civilians for whom it was intended to give to its wounded soldiers. So, you know, that's the situation that Israel faces. It faces really three wars. It faces a war in Gaza, which it's winning, although it's losing soldiers, obviously. But it's not allowed to fight that war. It's required to fight it with one hand tied behind its back and the other hand partially tied behind its back. That's one war. The second war is the war of public opinion, which because of CNN and the New York Times, it's losing, and students hear only one side of the story. Then there's the diplomatic war, actually four wars. The diplomatic war, UN resolutions condemning it. The United States abstains from the resolution, doesn't defend it, doesn't veto it. And then the one I'm deeply involved in, the legal war. The International Criminal Court is considering issuing arrest warrants for, in the first time in its history, and the first time in the history of any court, for the leaders of a democracy. They want to issue arrest warrants for Benjamin Netanyahu, for the secretary, the minister of defense, Gallant, and for others. The problem is the statute under which the International Criminal Court was created, the Rome Statute, doesn't permit them to do that for three independent reasons. First is Israel's not a signatory, either is the United States, to the Rome Treaty. So they can't start issuing warrants against President Biden, or they probably issue a warrant against former President Trump. They can't issue warrants against countries that aren't signatories. That's number one. Number two, Palestine is not a country, so it can't be ones bringing the complaint. But then the most important one of all, there's a concept in the statute. The only reason that Great Britain and France and Italy and others signed it is there's a concept called complementarity. It's a terrible word, complementarity. What it means is that the International Criminal Court is not a court of primary jurisdiction. It cannot bring cases against individuals, even in signatory countries, unless the signatory country is incapable of doing justice or unwilling to do justice. So it never has brought a case against England or France or Italy or Germany, because those countries have legitimate legal systems. So does Israel. Israel has probably the most sensitive legal system in the world when it comes to war crimes or when it comes to crimes against minorities. You know, Israel, what other country in the world? Israel has investigated and prosecuted four of its prime ministers. Four, count them. Rabin was prosecuted and had to leave office. Sharon was prosecuted, died before the prosecution could be completed. Olmert was prosecuted and went to jail. I visited him in his prison. I invented a new joke when I saw him in his prison. I started telling a joke. When an Israeli prime minister gives you his cell number, it's not necessarily his telephone. I visited him in his cell. And then, of course, there's nothing new. Four Israeli prime ministers have been investigated. One president has been prosecuted and sentenced to jail. What other country, democratic country, can boast of that record? And so it would be illegal against the statute for the International Criminal Court to investigate or to prosecute any Israeli leader as long as the Israeli government is engaged in investigation as it is. The Israeli legal system conducts ongoing investigations about every alleged violations of the law of war. And they do it very well. And they prosecute soldiers. They prosecute commanders. And if it's warranted, they prosecute prime ministers and they prosecute presidents and they prosecute cabinet members. So there is no possible jurisdiction that the International Criminal Court has had. And so, and this is an area I'm an expert in. I have, without disclosing contents of any of the conversations, I have been on the phone with Prime Minister Netanyahu on a regular basis, giving my advice and dealing with this issue, because I think it's a very important one. And I've made a prediction. If the International Criminal Court ever were to try to prosecute either an Israeli official or an American official or a British official, it would be the end of the court, because it would mean that the court itself has violated its own statute. You know, everybody loves the cliche, no one is above the law. Well, actually, people are above the law. Judges can't be prosecuted. Senators can't be prosecuted for some crimes. Representatives can't be prosecuted. We'll find out if presidents can, but there are people who are above the law. But the International Criminal Court can't be above its own statute. It can't say we're prosecuting this case. Yeah, we know the statute doesn't allow us to. There are three reasons why we have no jurisdiction, but we're going to ignore that. We're judges, is the old joke, equally applicable to the Trump case as to the International Criminal Court, where Sigmund Freud is called by the angel Gabriel and says, you know, God, he needs a psychiatrist. Freud says, God needs a psychiatrist? What's the matter with him? He says, he's having delusions of grandeur. He thinks he's a judge. And, you know, it's an old joke because judges think they're God and God thinks he's a judge. The judge Marchand, he's acting like he thinks he's God. I'm going to put him in jail. Yeah, I'm not going to worry about the Constitution. I'm going to put him in jail. The International Criminal Court, I'm going to put Netanyahu in jail. I'm not going to worry that the statute doesn't give us jurisdiction over Israel for three independent reasons, but we'll ignore the statute. We'll ignore jurisdiction. We'll just do what we think we have the power to do. Now, of course, the International Criminal Court doesn't have an army, so it can't come and arrest Netanyahu or Gallant or anybody else, or for that matter, American members of Congress or the Senate. The International Court also issued a statement the other day saying that if anybody dares to take recriminations against the court, that's a violation of the International Criminal Court statute, and we will go after them. Congress is now considering sanctions against the judges and the prosecutor if they go after Israel or America. And now what they're saying is we can go after senators and congressmen. Probably they're saying they can go after me, because if the court were to issue warrants against Netanyahu or others, I would call for sanctions. Yeah. So I'd be advocating recriminations against the court. I have a right to do that. Everybody has the right to call for whatever remedies they want to against a court. So we'll see what happens. We'll see if Israel were to go into Rafah. I suspect the court would issue warrants. If Israel accepts a ceasefire, maybe not. But Israel can't accept the ceasefire that Hamas has offered in a siphony way, you know, offer they know that can't be accepted. There isn't an Israeli government, I don't care how far left, that would survive if it said, all right, we're giving in to Hamas. We're never going to go after another Hamas leader again. We're just going to sit back and wait until the next October 7th occurs. No Israeli government could do that. Indeed, the United States has said it shouldn't do that. It just doesn't want them to go into Rafah. I think that's a very, very serious mistake. We went into Berlin, the United States. We went into Tokyo. We went into Hiroshima. We went into Nagasaki. We went into Dresden. How dare the United States and Great Britain lecture Israel? Israel's a tiny little country. It has to defend itself. And there are at least four brigades of Hamas terrorists left. People who rape, murder, and mutilate and kidnap. And the idea of leaving them and allowing them to strengthen themselves and rebuild their tunnels, no democracy would ever accept that. But no democracy is ever exposed to the double standard that Israel is exposed to, whether it be on college campuses today. Now, the college campuses, we're just talking about some of the most ignorant people on the face of the earth. And I'm talking about the faculty now. It dribbles down to the students. But the faculties of many of these universities are people you would not hire to do an errand at the store. These are people with no common sense. These are people who are prepared to make some of the most absurd arguments, intersectionality. The world is divided into two groups, the oppressed and the oppressors. No, it's not. DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion. These are absurd kind of nonsense things that we're hearing from professors. You know, I have to tell you, I grew up in Brooklyn. Streets of Brooklyn, smartest people I knew were on the streets of Brooklyn and in my elementary school. Second was my college, kids at Brooklyn College, smart kids, mostly ethnic kids, a lot of Irish Americans, Italian Americans, Greek Americans, Black Americans, Jewish Americans, really, really smart. Then Yale Law School, they were okay. And then Harvard Law School, by far the least intelligent of the four groups. They may have had good grades. I had good grades too. Everybody in my family has good grades. But the idea that these are the people who are making policy decisions. I mean, think about Barack Obama, the worst foreign policy president in modern history. He didn't have a foreign policy. He had a foreign ideology. And it was mostly, we apologize. Oh, we've done so many wrong things. Let's do an apology tour. Let's throw ourselves on the ground and beg forgiveness from murderers and terrorists. I've really come to appreciate street smarts. I've really come to appreciate Thomas Jefferson's view. When you ask a professor or a plowman a hard philosophical question, the answer you get from the plowman is likely to be better than the one you get from the professor. I certainly have learned that in my experience. But if you think professors are bad on a scale of intelligence, that's nothing on the scale of courage. I have never met a group of less courageous people than tenured professors at major universities. I can tell you, they call me all the time. People say, oh, thank you for speaking out. Thank you. Well, why won't you speak out? Oh, no, no, no. We don't want to offend our students. We don't want to offend our colleagues. We don't want to offend the administration. No, no, no. Thank you for speaking out, but we won't speak out. What a disappointment. You know, 50 years teaching at Harvard, and I really came away with very, very low views of the institution. Many of my colleagues, not all, there are some very, very smart people, and there are one or two who have courage. I think I may be exaggerating. One or two. I think that may be a little high. But the idea that these are the people that students look up to, no, don't look up to them. Ask hard questions. See if they'll give you any answers. I think the American university is in a death spiral. And unless something is done to rescue it, we're going to have among the worst universities in the world. And that's a real come down from among the best universities in the world. All right, let's look at some questions. Professor, do you have any freedom of the press or freedom of speech concerns over the fact that Israel has shut down Al Jazeera News Network? Yes, I do. I'm opposed to that. I think Israel is strong enough to allow Al Jazeera to be as biased, bigoted. And I can tell you, I was on Al Jazeera. And they promised me they wouldn't censor my speech. Let me tell you what they did. They had me give my talk. And on the side, it was actually an interview. And on the side, everything I said, they didn't have the courage to confront me with it. But when it was on the air, they had rebuttals to it on the side, without me being given an opportunity to respond. So look, I would never watch Al Jazeera, and I'll never be on it again because they broke their promise to me, but I would not ban them. What I would do is have a contrary channel, or a channel that says, all right, you saw this in Al Jazeera, now here's the truth. That's the way to answer lies is with the truth. The way to answer bad speech is with true speech. Okay. Professor, the Biden administration has put on hold two shipments of ammunition to Israel for the first time since the October 7th attack. So far, the White House has offered no explanation. Is this the last straw for me? If it's true, it's the last straw. I haven't seen confirmations about this yet, but if if the United States has refused to send necessary ammunition for Israel to defeat Hamas and to defend itself, that to me would be no red line. Let's see what happens. So far, I think it's only Axios that has confirmed. The other networks haven't confirmed the news yet. Okay. Quotes me as saying, Black Studies Department is excellent. Alan, Claudia Gay is a complete racist fraud. Grievance studies people are bigoted clowns, all of them. There's no scholarship there, not even a scholarly endeavor. That's true of some departments, and it's true of some professors in all departments. But there are some very, very good people in Harvard's Black Studies Department. I can tell you, I know them. Henry Louis Gates Jr., I know others as well, who are very, very good. And so I have no problem with Black scholars who study Black literature. What I have a problem with is departments that have points of view and that take votes on how the world should be run, and take votes that we have to divest from Israel and we have to accept DEI. No, I don't believe departments should do that. And I don't believe there should be ethnic studies departments, period. Okay. Please, Professor, provide us with your current assessment of the Democratic Party as it relates to your ideology. Sorry for my cold. I have commented many times with questions about how you and others can continue to support the Democratic Party in light of what I see their ideology as compared to your thoughts on your shows. It's a good question. Look, I'm a liberal. I'm a liberal, and I support a woman's right to choose, that is abortion, up until the middle months. I support gay rights. I support a separation of church and state. I support reasonable climate and gun control. So I am not a conservative, and I don't support the Republican Party. But on the Democratic side, I hate the squad even more than I hate people on the, no, I would say people on the extreme right of the Republican Party and people on the extreme left of the Democratic Party. I have about the same views of them, and it's not positive. I'm concerned that the Democratic Party, the squad, which used to be only, you know, a handful or two handfuls of people, is now multiplying. And we saw some of the votes reflected by some of the people in the squad. There are some people in the squad that are absolute bigots, racists, and anti-Semites. And I think that President Biden and other Democrats should condemn them. Instead, Nancy Pelosi, who I have lost all respect for, refused to condemn them. And President Biden essentially endorsed and embraced AOC. Oh, I've learned to listen to that lady. What about being an anti-Semite? About calling for divestment against Israel? About calling for all cutting off of all aid to Israel? That's what you've listened to her for? So I'm having a lot of trouble with the Democratic Party, but I'm also having trouble with the Republican Party. You know, people like me who are pro-civil liberties, pro-Israel, pro-centrist politics, we don't have a home. We're uncomfortable with the Democrats, and we're uncomfortable with the Republicans. Please have one of the parties move more to the center, and then I would feel more comfortable with them. You have the right to protest, but it should be 100% illegal to cover your face while you do it. I agree with that. I don't think you have a right to anonymous protest unless you can demonstrate physical threats to your well-being, physical threats. Now, I'm not talking about mommy will find out that I'm a racist or uncle won't hire me to work in his law firm because I support rapists. No, that's not a good reason for allowing masks. Masks should be allowed to prevent COVID, but these kids don't care about that. But they should not be allowed to prevent embarrassment, loss of job, loss of status, loss of friends, or anything else. I think the marketplace of ideas has to remain open. And for it to remain open, it has to also include who's making the statement, what their background is. It's very important to know things like that. And it's very important to know that if you want to evaluate. Alan, did you ever dream of this turn of events regarding many of our citizens, including elected officials, being anti-Semitic? Yes, I definitely dreamed of it. I knew about it. There used to be senators, Democratic senators, to be sure, from Mississippi and Alabama, two come to mind, Bilbo and Rankin, I think they were, two racist senators. I think it was Bilbo who once refused to allow Jewish babies to come in during the Holocaust. And he said on the floor of the Senate, oh, they're Jewish babies now and they're pretty, but they'll grow up to be ugly adult Jews, and he wouldn't vote to allow Jewish babies to come in and be saved. So we've had racism, anti-Black racism, homophobic attitudes in the Senate. So it doesn't surprise me that elected officials follow their crowd, follow the constituents. And it doesn't surprise me that college students are a bunch of cult-like lemmings who perform like zombies following their cult leader professors. That doesn't surprise me. What does surprise me is that some ordinary Americans, not too many, thankfully, but seem to be accepting the bigotry of the university and the bigotry of some others. So, you know, but we'll fight back. We fight back. As I've said before, I'm 85 years old. I can only fight with my pen, my tongue, my show. So see you tomorrow.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.